Retired Montana Supreme Court Justice Pat Cotter spoke at a Civics Education Day presented by MSU Wanderlust, the League of Women Voters, and Bozeman Public Library on April 23, 2018. The title of her talk was "The Montana Supreme Court: Structure, Function, and the Law and Principles That Guide the Decision-Making Process." This is the first of two parts.
What I want to talk about first is the structure and the function of the court system in Montana. In Montana, district court judges, and I'll explain their role in a minute, and Supreme Court justices are elected. We run as nonpartisans, so we don't run as Republicans or Democrats. District court judges run in the county in which they are seeking to serve, and Supreme Court justices run statewide campaigns. Now, many, many states have the arrangement that the Supreme Court justices are appointed by the governor. Say, for example, there is a nominating panel that interviews people who apply and gives two or three or four names to the governor, and he or she appoints the justice. And then about half the states have some form of election, whether it be referendum or statewide election like we have. Since Citizens United case, and I'll talk a little bit about that later, there's been a lot of money that has come into judicial elections. I think when I ran, my campaign cost a lot. I think it was up to $300,000 to get advertisements out and all of that. Now, even in Montana, they're running into several millions of dollars. There's a lot of money that comes in. There is a lot of effort, even from outside groups, to fund candidates for courts because the courts are seen as a repository of people that can make a difference in policy in the state. And so it's become a highly political thing. Sandra Day O'Connor has really been lobbying to have states change from an election situation to an appointment situation so that the big money will come out of these races. But in Montana, it's not by statute that we are subject to election. It's constitutional. And I'll talk about the Constitution some more throughout the day. But the Constitution provides that we have to run for election. And in order to change that, the Constitution would have to be amended, which is a big hurdle. And if I know anything about the people of Montana, it is that they're not going to willingly give up a right to vote for somebody in favor of not having that right. So I don't see it as a possibility that we'll ever amend our Constitution to go to an appointment system. So this is going to be kind of like drinking from a fire hose. What I'm going to do is go through the court systems and explain how they work, explain the kinds of cases that we get involved with, and then talk about the Constitution and statutes that govern what we do. Okay, let's start with the court systems generally across the United States. In this country, there are three types of sovereigns. Okay, we have the federal government, we have state governments, and we have tribal courts, tribal governments. Each of these is a sovereign. Each of these has certain jurisdiction over cases in front of it. And in some cases, those jurisdictions overlap. For our purposes, we're going to be talking about the state court system. But let me tell you a little bit about the federal court system. The federal courts decide cases involving federal statutes, federal laws, involving disputes between the states and disputes between citizens of the states. State courts cover cases arising in the state. And literally, we cover in our court system just about every possible dispute or conflict or legal issue that can come before a court. Because the Montana Supreme Court is the highest court in the state, let's talk about the court systems in Montana. Most people, if they go into a court in Montana, go into what we call the courts of limited jurisdiction. These are the courts that most people have experience with. Parking tickets, walking your dog off leash, speeding tickets, that kind of thing. And there are city and county courts in every county that handle these kinds of cases. By far, most people encounter the court system there and don't move on. If you have a small claims matter against somebody, you need to sue somebody for a few hundred dollars or a few thousand dollars, the courts of limited jurisdiction can handle those cases. The district courts are the middle tier of courts. Here in Bozeman, you have the district judges John Brown and Holly Brown and Rian McElyea now, who has replaced Judge Salvani. The district courts here are courts of general jurisdiction, and they handle all manner of cases. in the family law area, they'll handle divorces, custody cases, youth in need of care cases, delinquent youth cases. In the criminal arena, they will handle everything from a misdemeanors to felonies to capital murder. I mean, everything in between. Drug cases, murder cases, assault cases, sexual assault, every manner of criminal case. And then the civil cases are the other area of cases that the courts handle. And in order to distinguish between civil and criminal, I'm going to give you a couple of examples. But civil cases are cases between persons. In a criminal case, the state is the prosecutor, right? The county attorney brings criminal charges against someone. And a case is entitled State versus Jones, for example, if Jones is accused of drug possession or something of that sort. All criminal cases involve the state in the district courts. Civil cases involve all people who have a case that they want to bring against someone else. We're talking about, obviously, divorce cases are civil cases, custody cases are civil cases, car accident cases alleging negligence, cases involving easements, cases involving real estate easements, community zoning. I'm trying to get all my cases here. Contract cases, breach of contract cases. Cases involving defective products. One of the cases that reached our court involved a defective baseball bat. Yeah, it was a case in which parents of a young man who was pitching on a Legion team brought suit against Louisville Slugger. Yeah. Louisville Slugger made metal bats, and those bats were used by American Legion teams, and a young man was pitching in a game, and someone hit the ball off the metal bat, and it struck him in the forehead and killed him. The case alleged that the bats were defective because the way in which they were made made the ball accelerate so much faster off the bat than it would off a wooden bat that the reaction time was lowered and that he had no chance to get out of the way and not be hit. So that case went to trial. There was a verdict for the family for $750,000. This is about 10, maybe 15 years ago. And it came to the Supreme Court. And I'll explain how it gets to us in a minute. But that's just another example of the type of civil case that can be filed in the district courts. So in order to make the distinction between civil and criminal cases, and excuse me if I'm insulting your intelligence by being so simple, let's talk about a car accident case. So I'm driving down a street, and I've got a green light, and if somebody comes through the red light and hits me, okay? He is charged with running a red light, and it turns out he's also intoxicated, so he's charged with driving under the influence. Those are the criminal cases that can be brought against this man for hitting me. But I have a civil case against the driver. Why do I have a civil case? I've been injured in my car accident. My car is damaged. I've lost wages, I have medical bills, all as a result of the negligence of this man who struck me. So I can bring a case against him. And all of you have car insurance, I know this is where your insurance comes into play. If someone sues you, your insurance hires a lawyer to represent you in that case. So that's an example of a civil case and a criminal case that can both arise out of the same set of facts. There's another difference between civil and criminal cases. Well, a couple of big differences, other than who can bring them. When a civil case goes to trial, you're entitled to a jury. And if you have a jury of 12 and 8 of 12 jurors agree, you can win your case. You don't need a unanimous verdict in a civil case in Montana. In a criminal case, there is a presumption of innocence for the defendant, and so until and unless there are 12 jurors, there have to be 12 jurors to convict. It has to be a unanimous verdict in order for a conviction to happen in a criminal case. So that's the difference between those two. Now, also in civil and in criminal cases, sometimes there's no jury. A person who has a right to a jury trial can waive the jury trial and try his or her case straight to the judge. Why would someone do that? Well, if your case involves complicated legal issues and you think the judge is going to understand it better than a jury, you might want a judge to handle it. I once picked a judge trial rather than a jury trial because I was going to be trying a case representing a Great Falls person against a Havre person, and I was going to be trying the case in Havre. Okay? And I knew that the person who was the defendant was well known in Havre. And so I think I'm going to get a better shake. Maybe I'm wrong, but I think I'm going to get a better shake if I have a judge decided than if I have a jury of that defendant's peers looking at me saying, yeah, maybe she's got a case, but on the other hand, we want to protect Mary Jane, you know? So there are a variety of reasons that someone might choose to have a civil case rather than a criminal case. If a criminal defendant wants a jury trial, that's the end of discussion. The state cannot override that, okay? So most criminal cases involve a jury. And again, in a criminal case, a jury of 12 has to agree. In a civil case, 8 out of the 12 have to agree. So before I get into what the questions are that a jury and a judge decide, I want to point out the fact that not all cases that are filed go to trial. In fact, I would say 10% of the cases that are filed, either criminal or civil, ever end up in a trial. The other 90% are resolved usually by settlement or by a plea bargain. In the criminal case, the defendant's charged with assault. Okay? The defendant gets a lawyer. The lawyer and the prosecutor talk and see if they can strike a bargain. You know, I'll plead guilty to misdemeanor assault if you'll dismiss the felony charge. That kind of thing. Felonies carry a lot more possibilities of imprisonment and also a lot of ramifications if you're found guilty of a felony. So there are plea bargains that go on between the lawyers and the prosecutors, and eventually they can agree to enter a plea to a lesser charge in exchange for a dismissal of the bigger charge. So those don't go to trial. In the civil case, we have mediations and settlements where a party wants $100,000, the other party says, I'm not paying you a dime, it wasn't my fault. Sometimes those cases don't resolve because they're too far apart, but sometimes it's a question of money. I want $100,000 for my pain and suffering and for my medical bills, etc. The other side says, you know, I'm going to admit I was at fault in this accident, but I know you had a host of other issues before you had this accident, and I'm not paying for all your other problems just because you got injured in this accident. So there's that same kind of back and forth as you would have with the prosecutor and the defense attorney in a civil case. And you try and resolve it, and maybe you agree on an amount, and then that case is settled and the case is dismissed. One other way that a case will not go to trial is if someone brings a case and the judge decides as a matter of law, and I'll get into what that means in a minute, that there is no way that this person could prevail in a claim against the other person based upon what the law says. And so a judge can at times dismiss cases before they ever get to trial if there's no legal basis for the case to go forward. Generally, and this is an oversimplification, but I think it helps to understand how the court system works. When a case is tried in the district court, there are what we call issues of fact and issues of law. Issues of law are issues that a judge generally decides because he or she is familiar with the law. And I'll give you some examples of what those are in a minute. Usually before a case is tried, there are all sorts of motions filed by both parties. The parties ask, for example, judge, the other side wants to bring in evidence of my client's past convictions for other crimes. As a matter of law, you should not allow that evidence into place. And if you've ever seen Law and Order, one of my favorites, you know, it's kind of like a busman's holiday. I go home and watch Law and Order. But if you've ever seen those cases, you know that there are motions, what they call motions in limine, motions to exclude, motions to admit certain evidence, all matters that the judge has to decide before the trial goes forward, hopefully. Sometimes they come up out of the blue right in the middle of the trial and the judge has to decide them right there. But legal issues are issues of law, pretty simply. Fact issues are issues for the jury. And what I mean by fact issues are that the jury are the people who decide who's credible, who can be believed. You know, if a case comes to trial, that there's a big disagreement about what happened, or a big disagreement about whether money ought to change hands, or a big disagreement in a criminal case about guilt or non-guilt. So one witness is going to testify one way, one is going to testify another way. If two people, you know, collide in a narrow road, each blames the other one for crossing the center line. So the jury is going to hear different versions of the same facts. And the jury has to decide who is credible, who the jury will believe and who the jury will disbelieve. And because that is a unique aspect of what a jury does, well, let me go back a little bit. There has to be sufficient evidence to support any judgment or verdict that is made by the court, but sometimes the court's going to have two different versions before it. And so the jury decides, the jury votes and says, eight or nine people say, you know what, I don't believe this plaintiff. I believe the defendant's version, or I believe the eyewitness version, and therefore we're going to rule in favor of the defendant in this case because we find that their witness is more credible than the others. When a case eventually gets to the Montana Supreme Court, which we'll reach in a few minutes on appeal, we will look at questions of law and see how a judge decided certain legal questions if there's an appeal from a decision of the court. Never in my 16 years did we overturn a verdict based upon the factual determinations of the jury. And there's a good reason for that. When we get briefs and we get cases on appeal, we look at the page. We don't have witnesses in front of us to testify. We aren't able to look in the eye the person who gave testimony and say, I don't believe him, but I believe her. The jury could do that. And because that's a jury function, unless there's absolutely no evidence to support a judgment or a verdict, we're not going to overturn a finding of fact by the jury or a determination of whom they will believe or disbelieve. So even though appeal is available in a lot of instances in cases, and when people lose, they usually try to appeal, we will not disturb the factual determinations that were made by the jury. So questions of law. I'm going to give you a couple of instances so you'll understand what I'm talking about. The judge, as I said, reviews pretrial motions and looks at the motions of different parties and makes rulings ahead of time. But then during the trial, the judge has to rule on the admissibility of evidence. Someone says, objection, Your Honor. One of the witnesses says, I know Mr. Smith did this because my neighbor told me she saw him do it. Objection, Your Honor, hearsay. That's hearsay. That is someone saying, giving testimony about the truth of a matter over which he or she doesn't really have any personal knowledge, okay? More complicated questions. Should a defendant in a rape case have the right to bring in the sexual history of the rape victim? Big issue. Is evidence of the past criminal conduct of the defendant admissible? Say a defendant is before the court on charges of sexual assault, and the state, to buttress the case, to make the defendant look bad in front of the jury, wants to tell the jury, hey, this isn't his first merry-go-round. He was charged with assault on somebody else. He's got drug possession charges, etc. The district judge has to decide, is a conviction for a drug charge going to make it more or less likely true that he's guilty of sexual assault? Okay? So that's a type of case. It changes if the state wants to bring in the fact that the defendant was previously convicted of sexual assault of somebody else under similar circumstances and in a similar time frame as to what the charge is now. So a judge may say, I'm going to admit the previous conviction for sexual assault because it shows a pattern that this defendant has engaged in. I'm not going to admit evidence of a previous conviction for drug charge because it's not going to make it more or less likely to be true that he engaged in sexual assault. Now, what if somebody's been charged with a criminal with sexual assault but not convicted? Does that come in? See, you change one little fact, and the judge has to decide all of these different legal issues. The question is the evidence relevant to the charge? And if it's not relevant, then generally judges will not allow the evidence to come in. You've probably also seen that in a lot of cases, like in the baseball bat case I talked about, people bring in expert witnesses. If you claim that an accident damaged your heart, you have to have a doctor come in and say, yes, there's a connection between this accident and the heart condition. The other side's going to come in with an expert that's going to say there's no connection between the car accident and this heart condition. So again, credibility of even expert witnesses has to be determined by the people that sit on a jury. If the state wants to bring in an expert that's really doesn't have the credentials to give expert testimony, the judge has to decide as a matter of law, does that expert get to testify? I mean, if I try to bring in a cardiologist to prove that someone has a sexually transmitted disease, that's not going to work because the cardiologist is not an expert in that field. So anyway, that's kind of the things that you see in these cases. You see expert witnesses, you see doctors in medical cases, and you see eyewitnesses that come in and testify. Let's assume that we have, the case has been tried. At the end of the case, at the end of all the testimony, the district judge instructs the jury. And again, this is a function of law. The district judge says, in Montana, a person is negligent if he or she lacks reasonable care in the handling of their automobile or something. The judge will instruct the jury on the law of a crime. Here's what the statute says about what is the elements of sexual assault. The judge will instruct on, it's up to the jury to believe who they want to believe, and the judge will instruct on all theories of the case. So the judge delivers the law to the jury. They're equipped with what they know from the testimony, and then they go in and deliberate. And then, hopefully, unless you have a hung jury, which is someplace we won't go today because it's too complicated, if the jury reaches a verdict, then the judge will finalize that verdict and enter a judgment. At that point, there's going to be a winner and a loser in that case, right? There's going to be the winner who won, maybe the state won the criminal conviction, or the plaintiff won a money judgment against the defendant. At that point, the party that lost has the right of appeal. And that's where the Montana Supreme Court comes in. Any judgment, final judgment, from a district court can be appealed to the Montana Supreme Court. What happens on appeal? What does the Montana Supreme Court do? Our main function is to consider appeals from cases tried in district courts. The loser appeals, and we have to resolve the issue. Now, you've probably all heard that the U.S. Supreme Court has this luxury of saying, no, so-and-so's trying to get to us, we're not going to consider that case, because they don't have to. But we, as the Montana Supreme Court, have to consider every case that comes before us. We don't have a choice. We can't go out and pluck cases and say, I'd like to hear this case, and not that one. If someone appeals and their appeal is in order, there's a lot of procedural things that have to be done, we have to take up the case whether we want to or not. And believe me, there are plenty of times when we'd rather not take up the case. An example would be a case in which there is very poor lawyering. And let me explain why that's a problem for a court on appeal. A person may bring a case on appeal, and because of the facts and because of the way the law is applied, if we decide the case in a particular way, it's going to make bad law. What do I mean by bad law? Our decisions that we finally reach in cases on appeal resolve the case before us. You know, the people know whether they win or lose. But our cases are also published, and they become what we call precedent. And you've probably all heard of precedent. Precedent means that there's a case out there with similar legal issues where the court ruled in a particular way, and someone else who comes along later is going to want to say, Judge, you have to rule in my favor on this issue because here's how you ruled last time when the same issue was presented to the court. So sometimes bad lawyering makes bad law, and we don't want to announce what a decision is in cases like that. So on occasion, we put out what we call unpublished opinions. Okay? Most opinions are published. You can get online and find them. And I'll tell you a little bit more about that. But when we issue an unpublished decision, it's because it really is not something where the opinion's going to have any value to other people. It might be just a unique fact situation. And so we issue an opinion, the people get their answer in their case, but it doesn't become precedent for other people to rely on. Okay. So let's talk about the structure of the Supreme Court. There are 7 members of the Montana Supreme Court. 7 as opposed to 8 for obvious reasons, right? We can't have an even number. So what happens is that when a party loses and appeals from a district court, the first thing that comes to the court is the file from the district court. So you guys have all seen where there's court reporters doing this like crazy in the courts. All of that is transcribed. So the testimony may have lasted a day or, in complicated cases, a month. All of that comes to the court. A transcript of everything that happened in the courtroom comes to the court. Also coming to the court are all the motions and the briefs and the arguments that the parties filed in the district court. All the rulings of the district court that happened along the way, excluding evidence, admitting evidence, and all of that. So we get that entire record, comes up to the clerk of court. Then the parties file briefs with the court. The party that lost is the appellant. He or she is trying to convince us to overturn what happened in the district court, usually on an issue of law. For example, Your Honor, the judge instructed the jury, blah, 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 and that's a misstatement of the law, and as a consequence, the jury was misled, and therefore you should reverse that verdict and send it back and instruct the judge to do it the right way. That's a real simple type of appeal that can happen. So the appellant files a brief. There are very meticulous rules about briefs that can be filed in the court, what they have to contain, how long they can be, etc. Because brief is a misnomer, trust me, in some of these cases. And then the respondent is the party that won. And the respondent's going to file a brief and say, don't overturn this judgment. The court got it right. And then the appellant has one more shot because it's their burden to persuade us to change what the court did. So they file a reply brief. So we have all of that. And we read all of the briefs for every case that comes up. And then we meet and confer. Now, we have a courtroom for an oral argument. And we had an oral argument down here last week, here in Bozeman. I keep forgetting I'm retired. The court had an oral argument last week down here on an ex post facto law. It was a kind of a technical argument. But the court probably hears oral arguments maybe 20 times a year. We get over 600 appeals per year. So we can't possibly hold an argument on every case. We pick the cases for argument where there's really some serious questions we want to ask the lawyers, where there's a constitutional issue of import that is going to be resolved. Cases like that we set for oral argument. And if there's oral argument, the lawyers come in and stand before the podium, may it please the court, and argue their case. If there's no oral argument, we decide the cases on the basis of the briefs and the record before us. The court meets once a week, for usually 3 to 4 hours. Every week, we review at least 6 new cases. In addition to that, we review prisoner petitions. You know that people charged with a crime have a right to a lawyer if they can't afford one. You've all heard that. You know, you have a right to an attorney. If you can't afford one, one will be appointed for you. But they have a lawyer only as far as their trial and their appeal. After that, they're in prison and they don't have a lawyer anymore. So they frequently file petitions with the court. We get about 20 of them a week. The Bureau of Prisons has miscalculated my release date. I'm being treated inhumanely in my cell block, etc. So in addition to reviewing new cases, we review all of these prisoner petitions once a week and issue orders on those. And we sometimes get extraordinary writs, which I won't go into, but that's another type of thing we have to read. We read on average 1,100 to 1,200 pages of material a week. And then the other job, of course, of the court members is to decide the cases after we've reviewed everything. And then once a decision is made in the court, the Chief Justice assigns one of us to write the opinion. In any case, you have to have at least 4 of the 7 justices agree on each issue. Sometimes it's different judges for different issues, but we have to come to a conclusion on each issue raised on appeal. Sometimes the appeal is one issue. Did the court err in instructing the jury? One issue, no biggie. We had a case that came to us that had 12 issues, each one significant in its own right, following a very complicated trial. So that takes a long time to go through all of that, to sort it out. And the interesting thing about the court is that we're collaborative. We really are. We were when I was on the court, and I know it's the same way now. We have disagreements, certainly. But for the most part, we hash things out. It's a very, very stimulating discussion, as you might imagine, when you get into certain issues. Once we get 4 of 7 to agree, then someone in the majority is assigned to write the opinion of the court. Thankfully, Every justice has two full-time law clerks, without which we could not function. We couldn't keep up. These are law school graduates who are very good at the law and very good at legal writing. And they will sit down with the justice that's been assigned the case, and I'll call my clerk in. I'll say, okay, we have to write this opinion. We, meaning you. The clerk sits down with the guidance of the justice and writes a proposed opinion. Okay? They're trained to do that. Issue one, did the district court err in refusing to admit this piece of evidence? Legal analysis, conclusion. Issue two, issue three, and on. Then the clerk gives that proposed opinion to me, and I work with the clerk to revise it, or I just revise it myself. Sometimes I would do that. I'm a kind of hands-on person when it comes to an opinion that's going to go out under my name, and so are all of the justices. So eventually it gets to a point where I think it says what it ought to say, and then I distribute it to the other justices. And they take a look at it, and they may say, you know, Cotter, I can go with you on issue two, but I would like the rationale to be differently stated. Maybe it's a good idea, and maybe I'll say, okay, I'll work with that and change the rationale until we get it to the point where at least four of us can agree this is the way the court's opinion ought to read. I would say that 80% of the time we agree on cases, on how they should come out. It's the 20% that you read about in the newspaper. It's the 20% where someone writes a fiery dissent saying that this court has this all wrong for the following reasons. So if I've written the opinion, I'm like this when I can see those dissents come across because I know that they're going to test my mettle a little bit. And so sometimes, frequently, the court says, you know, I think the dissent has it right, and we might flip. Or I'll say, I disagree respectfully, and I'm going to say in my opinion why I think you're wrong. And you can file your dissent, but I'm going to say why I think you're wrong. Or if I really want to say, I think your dissent's so bad, I'm not even going to address it in my opinion. I'm just going to go forward and, you know, finalize my opinion. So all of this goes on, and it's all a back and forth. Now, our conferences are closed to everybody but the justices. We have a rule in Montana that everyone's entitled to know what their government's doing and entitled to attend meetings of the government, a right to know and right to participate in what their government does. The exception is no member of the public or the press would ever get into a jury deliberation, and no member of the public or press or even a clerk gets into the deliberation of the court. Why is that? The last thing you want is somebody who's going to get hit with a verdict getting word that the court's discussing your case and it's not going well for you. You know, then they could do something to abscond or do, you know, and because they know what's coming. So there's no leaks, and there never has been a leak in the time I was on the court until the opinion comes out. Once the opinion comes out, that's the way the court speaks. Once an opinion comes out, for the most part, that case is over with. There have been cases in which there have been appeals from our court to the United States Supreme Court. In my 16 years, three or four. And might I add, we lost every one. The one that we lost, and I'm going to talk about it for a minute because I think it's so significant, is the Citizens United case. In Citizens United, a company wanted to broadcast a video leading up to the primary, critical of Hillary Clinton. And it was not just a commercial. It was a full-out 20-minute or half-hour video. And the McCain-Feingold Act, and there's a bipartisan blah, blah, blah act, I can't remember what it's called. They said you can't do that within X number of days before a primary. But it also said that no corporation or union could spend money endorsing or opposing a candidate. That was a rule. That was a rule in the United States. There were previous Supreme Court cases that upheld that rule. But in Citizens United, the court overturned its previous precedent and ruled that corporations have a right of free speech, just like people do. And they also held that the only way free speech can get across is if you have money. And we're not going to preclude people from associations of people, including corporations, from spending money to express their right to free speech. Controversial case. Now, we got it in Montana, and everybody looked at it, and everybody's like, oh, my gosh, well, now what? Well, There's this thing called the Supremacy Clause in the United States Constitution that says the U.S. Constitution is supreme, U.S. Supreme Court decisions are supreme, federal constitution is supreme. If you violate that, you violate the Supremacy Clause, okay? That's the last word. So when the Supreme Court came out with Citizens United, we had groups appearing before us right away saying, we want to run a bunch of ads, corporations want to run a bunch of ads. We said, you know, we're going to distinguish the facts in Montana from Citizens United in the hopes of getting the court to agree that Citizens United would not preclude us from having our laws. We had a 1912 anti-corporation, no, that's wrong, anti-corruption act in Montana that said corporations could not politicize or contribute to campaigns and ads because of all of the problems we had with the coal, with the mines and everything back in the early 20th century. So we bravely went on and issued this opinion that said we're going to keep this out because we're different than the case in Citizens United. The judge had said in Citizens United, if there's an appearance of corruption, there might be an issue, but here there isn't any. We said, well, in Montana, it would be an appearance of corruption. Well, that lasted 5 minutes. The court said, no, no, you cannot overturn or distinguish your case from ours. So there are many cases that go to the Supreme Court, from the United States Supreme Court. So let's talk about the law. What comprises the law? I know we talked about questions of law and cases, but I'm going to switch gears here and talk about the law that governs us in our jurisdiction. We have a constitution in the state of Montana. Every state has a constitution. Why does the state have a constitution? We already have a federal constitution that governs all of us. Why does the state have a constitution? Well, every state does, and our constitution in Montana was first passed in 1889 by a vote of the people. And then in 1972, there was a constitutional convention, and we wrote a new constitution. And it was an incredible feat. There were 100 people chosen to be delegates to the Constitutional Convention. Dorothy Eck from Bozeman, one of the most venerated. And they were not chosen by party affiliation. They sat alphabetically when they debated the Constitution rather than by party. It was really an amazing thing. And they passed the Constitution that now governs us today. And someone mentioned earlier when we were talking about the preamble to the Constitution, and I think it's worth reading. We, the people of Montana, grateful to God for the quiet beauty of our state, the grandeur of our mountains, the vastness of our rolling plains, and desiring to improve the quality of life, equality of opportunity, and to secure the blessings of liberty for this and future generations, do ordain and establish this Constitution. It's considered a very progressive constitution. It's considered one of the most progressive in the country. Now, the federal constitution, as I said, under the Supremacy Clause, is the top of the pyramid. State constitutions give similar rights to what federal constitutions give, a right to equal protection of the laws, the right to bear arms. They may state them differently, but they give similar rights. But as long as a state does not violate the federal constitution or federal law, it can give greater rights to its citizens than are given under the federal constitution. And that's what Montana has done. In Montana, we have several constitutional provisions that are not contained in the federal constitution. Article 2, Declaration of Rights. That is the second part of the Montana constitution. And it lists all of the rights of the people. The counterpart would be the Bill of Rights in the federal constitution. But ours is longer because we give additional rights that the federal constitution does not give. We have a right of individual dignity. We had a case brought before the court on the right of individual dignity where a person wanted to end his life with the assistance of his physician because he was terminally ill. And he claimed a constitutional right to die with dignity. Okay? We have rights of freedom of speech and expression in the press, similar to what the federal constitution has. But one of the most famous or infamous, or two of them, are the right to know. There is no federal constitutional right to know what your government is doing. Too bad. We wish they had that, right?
Yeah.
But no person shall be denied the right to examine documents or observe deliberations of all public bodies or agencies of state government. A state government cannot close a meeting unless they have a very, very good reason on the record. Otherwise, you're entitled to be there. One of the ones that is most often litigated is the right of privacy. There is no right of privacy in the federal Constitution. Some cases, courts have implied one, but Montana is one of only two or three states that have a right of privacy because it's important to many of the cases we decide. The right of individual privacy is essential to the well-being of a free society and shall not be infringed without the showing of a compelling state interest. The drafters felt that the people of Montana don't want to think about their government surreptitiously eavesdropping on them, recording their conversations, and that people have a right of personal autonomy in their body and in their medical choices, and that that right of privacy should not be infringed by the state. In other words, the state shouldn't pass a law taking away your right of privacy unless there's a really strong reason for doing so. The classic right of privacy case that came before the court in 1999 is called State versus Grison. This was a case brought by six homosexual persons. There was a statute on the books in Montana that said that sexual relations between two persons of the same sex constituted deviant sexual conduct, and it was a crime. Consenting adults in their own privacy, it was criminal. And these six people came before the court and they said, we have a right to privacy in our personal conduct that is performed privately, and that the state has no compelling state interest in legislating what people can do in the privacy of their own homes with their own consent. And the court ruled in favor of the plaintiffs in that case and said that statute that criminalizes consensual behavior between adults is an unconstitutional invasion of the right of privacy. So, when the court rules on something like that, that's the end of it. That statute can't be enforced. The irony is that that statute remained on the books for the next 15 years because the legislators had no will to take it off the books. Now, it couldn't be enforced because of what the court had ruled, but it wasn't until, I think, 2015 where they finally agreed to take it off the books. So we have the right of privacy. We have the right of individual dignity. We have the right to know. We have the right to a clean and healthful environment. That is a constitutional right that is certainly not contained in the federal Constitution. And sometimes cases come to us in which some of these rights are competing. These rights compete. These particular rights, the right of privacy, the right to know, the right to a clean and healthful environment, are considered so fundamental that the state has a high burden to prove when it tries to enact a law that limits those rights. It has a high burden to demonstrate why it has such a compelling interest in doing that to the detriment of the people who rely on the Constitution. So let's switch horses for a minute. The Constitution here is about 1,200 pages long, the Montana Constitution. The most litigated things come under this Declaration of Rights that we just saw. There are 35 different rights set forth in there. Some of them are not fundamental, some of them are. But again, if it's a fundamental right, the state has a high burden to carry. But the Constitution also addresses the general government, how elections are run, the legislature, the executive, the judiciary, revenue, finance, environment, natural resources, education, public lands, local governments, etc. Very brief reference to all of those things in here on how those are to be set up. But obviously, the Constitution cannot cover every instance and cannot have every law that we live by. This is the statutes of the state of Montana. So these all set out what the laws are that govern us. I mean, everything from what you need to get a license as a cosmetologist to particulates in the air and environmental laws, criminal laws, every kind of law you can think of are contained in these books. And they're amended every other year sometimes when the legislature comes to town. Maybe new laws are passed or there are amendments to the laws. The laws as passed by the legislature cannot contravene the Constitution. And if they do, that's when people come to the court and say, it is what the law passed by the legislature unconstitutionally has limited my right of free speech, my right to know. A lot of people come to court and say, I was thrown out of a public meeting, and I have an absolute right to be there under the Constitution. So we frequently get cases involving the Constitution, and we frequently decide cases and sometimes have to balance the different rights. I'm going to give you a classic case in which that happened. We have a right to know what our government is doing, and we have a right of privacy. So some years ago down in Billings, two teachers were involved in sexual relations on the school property. They were found out, and the school decided to discipline them, but they didn't release their names. Now, the Billings Gazette found out about it. And who vindicates our right to know? It's usually the newspapers, interestingly enough, because they find out that something happened and the public has not been told about it, so the newspapers try and get the records. And what happened here is the newspaper wanted records of who these teachers were, what type of discipline had been imposed by the school district, whether or not they had been suspended. Now, the teachers said, we have a right of privacy. We don't want our names splashed all over the newspapers. We don't want this incident splashed all over the newspapers. Both of these rights are fundamental rights. So who wins in that case? Well, as you can imagine, it came to the court. So Article 2, Section 9 of the Constitution, I already read you Article 10, the privacy, right to know, no person shall be deprived of public records, etc. Now, this is a public school, so the right to know would apply here because the right to know applies to knowing what your government is doing. A school is considered a government entity. So the people argued and their union argued on their behalf that they had a right of privacy and that they had a reasonable expectation of privacy. Now, the Constitution right of privacy says that right of privacy can be infringed only when the government has a compelling state interest. So what did we do in that case? We said the newspaper wins. We said that the teachers have no reasonable expectation of privacy when it comes to their conduct that takes place on public school property, that takes place in a building in which our children are to be educated, that takes place in a building where public taxes pay for them to teach our children. We said that because they're public employees, they do not have a reasonable expectation of privacy that would outweigh the merits of disclosure. So if the merits of disclosure are this information, the public deserves to know this, then the right of privacy gives way. Now, you change one essential fact in that case, and it would be totally different. If they were two employees in a private company, these rights restrain the government from doing particular things or taking away your right of free speech, your right to know, etc. The government and government employees and government institutions are the ones that are subject to these rights. If it's a private individual, private company, the Billings Gazette has no business going to a company and saying, give me all your records of how you disciplined an employee. So in that case, the Billings Gazette won and was able to publish the information. One of the things I want to talk about that you hear a lot about is activist courts, yeah, where you hear someone say they're legislating from the bench, right? Because there are three branches of government. We have the executive in Montana. We've got the governor. We've got the agencies of the government that enforce the laws. We have the legislature. The legislative branch passes the laws. They meet every 2 years. And then the judiciary are the courts that decide cases under the law and issue opinions. Some of the opinions are just going to be, you win on the negligence case, you lose. It's not a lot of gravitas in cases like that. But in cases involving constitutional rights, in cases involving the environment, it becomes a big deal. Usually the person who accuses a court of being activist is the person who lost the case, right? Okay, as a general rule. But the problem is that kind of activist court criticism presupposes that court cases are cookie cutter. You take certain facts, you take this statute clearly says you can't do this, therefore, why is it such a big deal? Courts can just issue decisions based upon the law, and that's the end of it. If cases are that simple, they never get appealed because they're resolved right off the bat. But what happens is that sometimes legislation, laws passed by the legislature, are not very clearly written. Go figure. Especially when they're complicated. It can be hard to draft a bill in complicated cases. And sometimes those laws come out, and then a set of facts comes before the court, and people go, I don't think that law covers this conduct. Or if it does, it's not clear whether the conduct is precluded or allowed. So it's the cases in which it's the law is tough to interpret, the facts maybe were not anticipated by the legislature when they passed the law. It's those kind of difficult cases in which you go to court, in which there's a battle. And sometimes both sides have a good point to make, and the courts have to resolve who wins in those situations. So it is not correct to assume that anybody can decide a case. You need to have training. You need to have the ability to look at the statutes and the law. And you need to be able to give your best shot when sometimes the facts and the law are not what the legislature expected them to be. So what happens if a law is passed by the legislature and somebody challenges it as unconstitutional? Like the law precluding the sexual conduct between homosexual adults. It comes to the court. The court says, well, that law is unconstitutional. And that doesn't happen very often, but it does happen. Is that the end of the road for the legislature? It's not. There are checks and balances is what I'm trying to say. The court says, this law is unconstitutional. We check the power of the legislature. So what does the legislature do? They come back the next session. They say, we're going to tweak that law so it doesn't have the constitutional infirmity, and the court won't overturn it. So they pass the law without the constitutional infirmity, and it goes forward. One thing courts cannot do, even though people accuse us of doing it, is to declare something unconstitutional because we don't like it. We can't declare a law as unconstitutional. We can't say in a particular case that comes before a district court, we're going to overturn that court because, man, I don't like that decision. There has to be a legal reason for the court to do what it did, and sometimes courts decide cases in a way that the Supreme Court doesn't like, but we have to let that stand if it's lawful and if the facts support it, even if we don't like the decision. So there is a limitation on the court system and on how far it can go when faced with a controversial judgment or verdict or a controversial law that was passed by the legislature. Or maybe we can start with questions now. And more things will come to mind as we talk, because we've got 25 more minutes, and this is supposed to be interactive. I think you raised your hand first.
I need for you to help clarify. You were talking about the difference between civil and criminal court.
Uh-huh.
I think the thing that I've always understood is the primary difference is the balance in evidence. Like in civil court, it's a preponderance of evidence.
That's true.
So
that's one thing I forgot to say, so thank you for bringing that up. We talked about the different votes for jurors, 8 out of 12 in a civil case, unanimous in a criminal case. But in a criminal case, the state has to prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt so that any juror would not have a reasonable doubt as to whether the defendant was guilty after the case was decided. In a civil case, it's a preponderance of the evidence. What's that mean? 51-49. 51% of the people on the jury find the facts a particular way. They can decide a particular issue in that way. But the person who's the plaintiff, who's suing in a civil action, just has to prove his or her case by a preponderance of the evidence. Now, one other thing where beyond a reasonable doubt comes in is when a law is challenged as unconstitutional, that burden applies to the person challenging the law as well. Has to prove it unconstitutional beyond a reasonable doubt. Were you finished?
Well, to that point, I wanted to understand what constitutes the Supreme Court saying, okay, you get a retrial.
Well, if we find that the district judge made an error of law that could have had an outcome or an impact on the case, instructed the jury wrongly, for example. We had a case in which we said the court erred as a matter of law in a criminal case when the court had the defendant brought into the courtroom in shackles, like, you know, walking like this. And that is permitted only if there's been a demonstrable effort by the defendant to disrupt the proceedings, and maybe he's dangerous. Maybe he's considered dangerous, and they're afraid that he's going to lash out or jump out at somebody. But the court has to have evidence that that person is dangerous before the court shackles the defendant. In this case, the court never had any of that evidence, but decided to have the defendant shackled anyway. Why does that make a difference? What, you're presumed innocent until you're proven guilty. And if the jury sits there and sees somebody brought in shackles, they're going to say, oh, the court thinks this guy is guilty and this guy is a bad actor. So it goes a long way in forming the juror's opinion. In that case, we said there was no legal basis established for shackling him. That was a mistake that could have had an outcome on the person's conviction. And so we sent it back. It's usually on an issue of law that we send it back.
There's something called the fully informed jury. The classic example happened in Wisconsin some years ago. The defendant had a drug charge. The law was clear that he was guilty, but the jury called him innocent. The jury was informed enough to feel they had enough power to know they could judge the fairness of the issue of law. Now, the jury maybe you could tell instinctively that drug laws are destined to collapse. How does Montana look at the fully informed jury issue?
Not well, and most courts don't. And the reason for that is that the law is delivered to the jury by the judge. And a jury may not like it. And a member of the juror may say, I know better than the court. But if the court delivers the law as the legislature has passed it, as courts have upheld it, the jury takes an oath to follow the instructions of the judge. Okay? That's part of the juror's oath. And if they refuse to do that, the fully informed jury says, say, I know better, then if the verdict of the jury comes back, and any court would look at it and say, this isn't in accordance with the law. The jury intentionally refused to follow the instructions of the court, which comprised the law. And then if they do that, it would probably be reversed. So it's a popular concept in some squares, but if you follow that to its extreme, a jury can decide to do whatever it wants and just disregard what the law is because they don't want the outcome to be a particular way.
Do you have any reflections on school funding? We are reading about school funding problems across the nation. And Montana seems to have a different approach allowing the courts to, if you will, help us make our decisions. What's your reflection?
Well, there is a case right now, and maybe you know about that case. The Constitution guarantees a free public education for our students, and it also requires a certain level of funding for schools. Most of it is not set forth in the Constitution, it's set forth in here. But a free public education is guaranteed to every student. There are two provisions of the Constitution that are in play right now in a case that was just argued 2 weeks ago. The legislature passed a law just last session that allows people to get a tax credit of up to $150 for contributions made to a scholarship group that then go to a religious school. So the law sets aside $3 million for the first year of this fund because every person who takes that tax credit takes money out of the coffers. It's $150 dollar for dollar credit for the contributions made. Article 5 of Section 11, no appropriation shall be made for religious, charitable, industrial, educational, or benevolent purposes to any private individual, association, or corporation not under control of the state. So there's another statute that's even more specific. Article 10, Section 6, aid prohibited to sectarian schools. The legislature, blah, 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 and public corporations and persons shall not make any direct or indirect appropriation or payment from any public fund or monies to aid any church, school, academy, seminary, etc. So we have two constitutional provisions that prohibit state money from being used directly or indirectly to fund religious schools. This is before the court right now. Because what happened after the legislature passed this bill is that the Department of Revenue, who would be in charge of giving that tax credit, said, well, I'm going to attach a rider to that bill that says, well, wait a minute, you've got to follow the Constitution here. None of that money that you want to get a credit for can go to religious schools. And they went to the district court, and the court said, nah, I'm going to throw out that Department of Revenue comment. I don't think it applies here. So now it's on appeal, and there are a bunch of groups and friends of the court and different groups who are challenging this as an indirect appropriation to a religious school.